In 1492, Christopher Columbus discovered America. We all know the story about the Nina, the Pinta, and the Santa Maria. And America slowly began to be colonized. And in 1607, Jamestown became the first permanent English settlement. Other settlements then began to spring up and grow rapidly. You know, the Mayflower landed in Plymouth, Massachusetts in 1620. Does anybody know the name John Winthrop? A couple of you do. Very good. He was the first governor of the state of Massachusetts and the Bay Colony, and was the chief figure among the Puritan members in New England. And in 1630, he delivered the following sermon before he and his followers reached New England. And I'd like to read this message to you today as a basis for my sermon. This message was famous largely for a phrase that was used called a city on a hill. And it was used to describe the expectations of the Massachusetts Bay Colony that they would have that example for the rest of the world to see. Mr. Winthrop's sermon also reveals how Massachusetts expected to be different from the world. So if you would, please be patient with me. I'm going to read through some of this, but it's important because it is going to outline the message. And he says, and I quote, "Now if the Lord will please to hear us and bring us into this place where we desire, then he has ratified this covenant and has sealed our commission, and will expect a strict performance of the articles contained in it. But if we neglect the observation of these articles, which are the ends of its propound, and dissembling with our God, will fall to embrace this present world and prosecute our carnal intentions, seeking great things for ourselves and our posterity, the Lord will surely break out in wrath against us and be revenged of such a people to make us know the price of the breach of such a covenant." I read that for the first time and I actually cried. Because I look at this and I say, this was America. This is what our country was supposed to be founded on. And it's not. And we've removed ourselves from God. And look at where we've become as a country. He continues and says, "Now the only way around this shipwreck is to provide for our posterity and to follow the counsel of Micah, to do justly, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with our God." That's fascinating. That if we had incorporated God into this country at the beginning, we would be a prosperous country. "For this end, we must be knit together in this work as one man. So we will keep the unity of the spirit of the bond in peace. And the Lord will be our God and will delight to dwell among us as his own people, and will command a blessing upon us in all of our ways, so that we will see much more of this wisdom and power and goodness and truth than we have formerly been acquainted with. We will find that God of Israel is among us when 10 will be able to resist 1,000 of our enemies, and when he will make us praise and glory, and that men will see the succeeding plantations, that the Lord may guide and watch over us." Again, I read this, and my wife and I like to go to Epcot at Disney, and there's a place there that we go that shows the history of America. And it shows how when this first country first started, just how prosperous and how happy we were as a country and how unified we were. He continues and says, "For we must consider that we will be a city on a hill." This is talking about Massachusetts. He was on the ship talking to the people as they were getting ready to come into this country. "So that if we will deal falsely with our God in this work we will have undertaken, and so cause him to withdraw his present help from us, we will be made a story and a byword to the rest of the world." Isn't that what's happening today? That the rest of the world in this looks at the United States and it's a joke. They laugh at us because of our morality has slipped so much. And we're not a country that's united, we're a country that's divided. He concludes and says, "And to shut this discord, that the with the exhortation of Moses, that faithful servant of the Lord, in his farewell to Israel in Deuteronomy 30, said, "Beloved, now there is set before us life and death, good and evil, in that we are commanded this day to love the Lord our God, to love one another and walk in his ways and keep his commandments and his ordinance and his laws, and that the articles of his covenant may be with us and to multiply us and to bless us wherever we go." But, the biggest word, but, three-letter word in the Bible, but, if our hearts will turn away so that we will not obey God and will be seduced to worship other gods and pleasure and profit and serve them, it is propounded to us to this day that we will surely perish out of the good land where we go to possess it. Therefore, choose life that our seed may live. You know, our country may have been founded on godly principles. And you know, maybe they didn't have it all right. Maybe they didn't know all the truth. But I believe that they tried their best and put God in the center of it, and he blessed it. And the United States became one of the greatest countries of all time. But he also warned this country that if we turn from him, that he would remove those blessings and add cursings to them, and that the end would be worse than the beginning. Brethren, we don't know how much more time we have left into the return of Jesus Christ. And we know that we are closer today than we were yesterday. And whether he comes back in our lifetime or not, we have a responsibility, as we heard in the sermonette today, to get ourselves ready and to be awake. If you want a title for my message today, it's simply, A City on a Hill. A City on a Hill. Let's go to Genesis chapter 12. Because the story of America should sound very familiar to all of us here today. Genesis chapter 12 and verse 1. It says, "And now the Lord said to Abram, get out of your country, from your family and from your father's house to a land where I'll show you." Can you imagine being told that today? To leave your family and your friends and everything that you know and go someplace that you've never been before. Abram did it. He did it in faith. He says, "I'll make you, Abram, a great nation, and I will bless you, and I will make your name great, and you will be a blessing. And I will bless those who bless you, and I will curse him who curses you, and in all the families of the earth you will be blessed." So we see here God called Abram the greatest nation of all time. And that was, of course, Israel. And the similarities between our two nations are profound. He then enters a covenant with Abram. We're in Genesis. Let's go to chapter 15. Chapter 15, as we start to unravel the story a bit. Genesis 15 and verse 12. "And now when the sun was going down, a deep sleep fell on Abram, and behold, horror and great darkness fell upon him. And then he said to Abram, know certainly that your descendants will be strangers in a land that is not theirs, and will serve them, and they will afflict them for 400 years. And the nations whom they serve I will judge, and afterwards they'll come out with great possessions." So we see that the covenant was extended down through his descendants, and it spoke about the time where they would be in captivity in Egypt. Let's go pick up the story in Exodus 19. This is just 7 weeks after leaving slavery in Egypt. Remember, the promise was to Abram and to his descendants. So we see here this is well over 400 years later. Exodus chapter 19 and verse 3. Exodus 19:3, it says, "And Moses went up to God, and the Lord called him from the mountain, saying, thus you shall say to the house of Jacob, tell the children of Israel that you have seen what I have done to the Egyptians and how I bore you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. Now therefore, if," again, one of the other big words in the Bible, if "you will indeed obey my voice and keep my covenant, then you will be a special treasure to me above all people, for all the earth is mine. You will be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. And these are the words which you will speak to the children of Israel." So we see that God entered into a covenant with the children of Israel and made them a special and a holy nation. Slaves. They didn't deserve it. They didn't do anything to earn it. God called them to be a special nation. He called them because of the promise that he made to Abram through the descendants and his children. But notice he used the word if, because this came with conditions. And they had a part to play as a model nation to all nations that were around them. God was calling them to be, you get it, a city on a hill. Different from all the other nations, the Hivites, the Levites, or the, not the Levites, because they were part of the Israelites, but the Hivites, the Jebusites, the Amorites, all the ites. Okay? God could have called any one of those nations, but he chose Israel, and he wanted them to be different and special. Let's go to Deuteronomy 8, because he told his children the same thing. These are the children that came out of Israel. Kind of taking you out around the long way today, but I think you're going to understand what I mean by when this is all done, where we're headed. Deuteronomy 8, verse 6. Remember, this is the children he's speaking to. "Therefore, you will keep the commandments of the Lord your God, to walk in his ways and to fear him." Same thing he told his parents. "For the Lord your God is bringing you into a good land, a land of brooks of water, of fountains and springs that flows out of the valleys and hills, a land of wheat and barley and of vines and fig and pomegranates, a land of olive oil and honey, a land in which you'll eat bread without scarcity, in which you'll lack nothing." I'm hungry just reading that. "A land whose stones are iron and whose out of whose hills you can dig copper." I mean, they were going to a place that was amazing. This country has so many resources in it, doesn't it? We could sustain ourselves, and we sustain the rest of the world with whatever we have. I'm not saying this is the promised land, but you know, the amount of resources that they had, it was almost like the promised land to them. Verse 10 says, "And when you've eaten and are full, and then you will bless the Lord your God for the good land which he has given you. Beware, beware, watch out, be careful, pay attention to, that you do not forget the Lord your God by keeping his commandments." Why? Because they will forget. That's what we are. We're humans. We forget things. "You're going to forget his judgments, his statutes, which I command you to this day, lest when you've eaten and are full, and you've built beautiful houses, and you dwell in them, and your herds and your flocks multiply, and your silver and your gold are multiplied. You know, you have cars in the driveway. You have more toys than you can know what to do with. When your heart is lifted up and you forget that the Lord your God is who's the one who brought you out of the land of Egypt from the house of bondage. Just like us spiritually, brethren, he called us out of darkness into his marvelous light. Don't forget that," he says. "Who led you through that great and terrible wilderness through which there were fiery serpents and scorpions, and a thirsty land where there was no water, who brought water for you out of the flinty rock, who fed you in the wilderness with manna, and your fathers did not know, that he might humble you and might test you to do good in the end." You know, their shoes didn't wear off their feet. In the daytime, they had a cloud over their head to keep them cool. At night, they had a fire to keep them warm. They had everything. Verse 17, "And then you will say in your heart, my power and the might of my hand have gained me this wealth." Wow. Talk about being brave and bold. "And then you will remember the Lord your God, for it is he, God, who gives you the power to get wealth, that he may establish his covenant with you that he swore to his fathers to this day." That same promise that he made to Abram. "Then it will be to you that if anyone forgets the Lord your God and follow other gods and serve them and worship them, that I testify to you this day," the same thing that was said back when John Winthrop was reading those words to those that were coming to America, "that you will surely perish, and that the nations which the Lord destroys before you, so you will perish because you would not be obedient to the voice of your Lord. Again, I read these words and I think, how sad that they just didn't follow the example and just listen to what God was telling them. They would have been a prosperous and healthy and happy nation. So why is this so important? What does this have to do with us? If you read the church booklet, the United States and Britain in Bible Prophecy, you'll see that we are that nation that God has blessed and that has carried on that covenant that he made with Abram. That same thing that was talked about in Genesis 48, Joseph's sons, Ephraim and Manasseh, United States and Great Britain. More importantly, and this is where I want to focus my attention today, more importantly, we as baptized members of God, that's God's family, are a part of that covenant too. That means we need to be following all the examples that were just explained to us in the pages of this word. Because, brethren, God has called us to be a city on a hill as well. Let's go to Matthew chapter 5. Just like Israel, just like America, we have a responsibility to obey God, to be different, to be that model nation, to be the examples for the rest of the world, because someday we're going to be teaching them. Matthew 5:14. You are the light of the world. You, put your name there, whoever you are, me, each one of us sitting in this room today, are the light of the world. A city on a hill that cannot be hidden. I went to the feast one year in San Diego, California, and we flew into Las Vegas, and we drove out to San Diego, and we had to drive back home. Anybody make that drive out from San Diego to Las Vegas at night? A couple of you have. All right, it's boring as all get out. I'm not going to lie to you. There's nothing to see. It's the desert, okay? But as you're driving, you can see in the distance the lights of Las Vegas. I mean, it's bright. And as you get closer, I don't know how far out you can see them. I don't know how many miles it is. But I remember one time we came over the top of one of the hills and the city was right there in front of us. And it was beautiful. It's just all lit up. I'm not saying that Las Vegas is a good place, but I'm just using the light as an example. But that's what God says to us. That's how he looks at us. Because in a dark world where there is no light, that light that you shine is going to shine out and stand out like a sore thumb. He says, nor do they light a lamp and put it under a basket or under a lampstand, and it gives light to all who are in the house. You know, fortunately for today, we have a little thing called the light switch that we could turn on and off when we want light in our house. Back then, they had lanterns. You couldn't put anything on top of it because it would just smother all the light. You couldn't see anything. But notice he says, verse 16, he says, let your light shine before men so that they may see your good works and glorify your Father in heaven. Your good works. What are your good works? What you say, what you do, how you treat other people, how you looked at work, at school, at church. You know, believe it or not, you know, again, I've always said this before, you may be the only Bible that somebody will ever read. How you live your life and that light that you reflect will determine maybe whether or not somebody is going to be turned on to the truth or not. Every day we need to be witnessing the truth to others by how we live our life and be ready to give an answer for that hope that lies within us when they ask us that question. We're called to be lights and examples, again, out of this dark world. He takes it a step further. Let's go to 1 Peter chapter 2. 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 9. Again, sounds familiar. We just read this not too long ago. He says, but the only difference is now he's not talking to ancient Israel here. Okay? He's talking to us, us, you and me, you and I. You are a chosen generation. Same thing he told ancient Israel. A royal priesthood, a holy nation, a model nation, his own special people. Not because we deserve it. No way. That you may proclaim the praises of him who called you out of darkness and into his marvelous light. That's what he expects us. That's what he's called us for. That's our job. That's our responsibility. For once you were not a people, but now are the people of God, and who had not obtained mercy, but now have obtained mercy. Again, same thing he told ancient Israel. And you know, I'm a firm believer that if you want to know what God is going to do, look at what he did. Because God is the same yesterday, today, and forever. Right? He repeats himself. And what happened with ancient Israel has happened to America, is happening to us. And it's going to happen to our children in the future, or at least until the return of Jesus Christ comes. But like ancient Israel, God has conditions for us as well. And if he is to be our God, then we must change how we live our life. I'd like to go back to what John Winthrop said in his message. Let's go back to Deuteronomy chapter 30 for a minute. Deuteronomy chapter 30 and verse 15. Deuteronomy 30, 15. He says, see, I have set before you today life and death, good. Life and good, death and evil. It's the same thing that he did for Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden. He set before them choices, the tree of life and the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And he says, you can have any your choice of any one. Take your pick. And he could have very easily have just put one of those trees in a garden and not given them the choice. But he didn't, did he? He doesn't do that for us today, does he? He allows us to go through this life to experience in some of these trials because it builds character. It helps us to be able to encourage us to make the right decisions and the right choices. He did the same thing with ancient Israel. Gave them those two paths, gave them the choices to go down. America is the same way. Again, we had that opportunity when our country was first founded. But he said, I set before you those two things, life and death, good and evil. He says, I command you today to love the Lord your God. He didn't ask us. He's commanding us and telling us to do this. To walk in his ways and to keep his commandments and his statutes and his judgments, that you may live and multiply, and that the Lord your God will bless you in the land you go to possess it. Again, as we go through our Christian walk, hopefully our end result is going to be God's kingdom. That's where we're headed towards. But along the way, we have to be able to make the right choices and to change how we go in our direction that the rest of this world is going in. He says, but if your heart turns away so that you don't hear and you're drawn away and worship other gods and serve them, or if you're going to follow what everybody else is going to be doing around you in this world, then I announce to you to this day that you will surely perish and you will not prolong your days to go in the land which you will cross over the Jordan to possess it. And then he tells him here in verse 19 to choose life that you and your descendants may live. Brethren, our future depends upon the choices that we make. And we're either going to be a light and we're going to stand out and show other people how God wants us to live, or we're just going to go with the flow and look like everybody else. So, I have 3 points. How can we be a city on a hill? How do we do this? Point number one, walk in his ways. Walk in his ways. What does it mean to walk? Not one foot in front of the other, literally. But the word walk in the Hebrew means to behave or to continue or to follow or to exercise or go about on a journey. Brown Driver Briggs says this word walk means to, or means a manner of life. And I like the Greek because it says to walk at large, especially as proof of ability. Proof of ability. Prove that you can actually walk this way and follow in God's footsteps is what this actually means. Ways, the word ways means a course of life or a mode of action, or in the Greek, it's a road or a progress. So if you put this together in Sal's easy, common to understand terms, it means God is telling us that if we want to be a city on a hill, we have to conduct ourselves every day on his course of action in his life and not ours. If we want to be a city on a hill, we have to be doing things God's way, not our way. And Mr. Bedetti here gave a message about giving up our sovereignty and our own free will or our own will. That's hard to do, isn't it? It's hard to give up your own will because I think I know what's right. You could put in your notes Proverbs 14:12. It says, there's a way that seems right to a man, but the end thereof are the ways of death. Why? Because I think I'm always right. Ask my wife. I'm perfect. Right? I can't do anything wrong. I'm a legend in my own mind. But I know that that way of thinking isn't going to get me any closer to God. And it's only going to turn other people away because they're not going to see God's life in me. I'm not going to reflect that light of God. I'm just going to reflect Sal's light, which is nothing. 1 Corinthians 3, I will go there. Remember, we're talking about how to be a light or how to be that city on a hill. How to walk in God's ways. We have to get out of our own way. That's the first step. Get out of your own way. Again, if I just remembered that every single time I do something, I'd be all right. 1 Corinthians 3:18. Let no one deceive himself. Right? He's saying, Don't be tricked. Don't be fooled. If anyone among you seems to be wise in this age, let him become a fool that he may become wise. So you think you know it all? You think you're smart? You're not. He says, for the wisdom of this world is foolishness with God. As wise as we think we are, God looks at that as foolishness. For it is written, he catches the wise in their own craftiness. And again, he says, the Lord knows the thoughts of the wise, that they're futile. They're empty. Right? God gives us directions. I don't know if any of you have gone camping before. Right? You're going down a trail on a campsite or campground. Right? The trail signs are there for a reason. Right? They help get you to where you need to go, right? And if you want to get to point A to point B, you have to follow the signs. And I know for me, I have a hard time following signs. But I know if you get off that path on some of those trails, you may not be able to get back. And some of the signs tell you about some of the warnings that are along the way. Watch out for the animals. Watch out for the drop off in this. You know, there might be a ditch or something that's going to hurt you. They're there to protect us. Same thing with the speed limit, right? They're not suggestions, by the way. Speed limit is there for a reason. It helps keep you safe when you're driving on the road. Another example could be the Sabbaths and the holy days. They're reminders and markers along the way to help us to get our journey along. That's why the Sabbath is so special. 52 of these every year we get to keep to be able to help make sure that we're always kind of just keeping that truck down the right road. Because it's so easy to get off the path and find your own way. Let's go to Jeremiah 17. And we're going to read verse 9. But I want to start in verse 5. Because we always talk about Jeremiah 17:9, right? The heart is wicked, desperately wicked. Who can know it? But when I put this together and I started studying this a little bit, this really came alive to me. Jeremiah 17, verse 5. Remember, we're talking about walking in God's ways and being a city on a hill. Okay? Jeremiah 17, 9. Thus says the Lord God, cursed is the man who trusts in man and makes flesh his strength and whose heart departs from the Lord. You know, there's something said about trusting other people. God says, don't do that. When you put your trust in other people, they're always going to fail you. He says, for he will be the person who trusts other people, other men, will be like a shrub in a desert, which is not a good thing. I don't think shrubs grow in deserts. And they will not see the good when it comes, but will inhabit the parched places in the wilderness and in a salt land which is not inhabited. So he gives the example of a shrub in a desert as somebody who's going to be trusting in somebody else. Okay? But he says, blessed is the man who trusts in the Lord, who walks in his paths, who follows in his ways, and whose hope is in the Lord. His hope is in the Lord. Proverbs 3, 5 and 6, trust in the Lord with all your heart and lean not to your own understanding. And in all your ways acknowledge him and he will direct your paths. Again, we are our own worst enemy sometimes. We shoot ourselves in the foot when we think we know what's best for us. And God says, just trust me. Let me take you to where you need to go. Follow those signs that I'm giving you and you'll get to where you're going safely. Verse 8 says, for he, the one who trusts in God, will be like a tree planted by the waters, not the shrub in the desert, who spreads out his roots by the river and will not fear when the heat comes, but when its leaf is green, he will not be anxious in the year of drought, nor cease from yielding fruit. This person's going to actually bear fruit and show the Spirit of God and show others God living in them how to be a city on a hill. When we trust God. And then verse 9, the famous verse, the heart is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked. Who can know it? And what really stuck out for me with this verse was, if you tie it back to what we just talked about, is that we trick ourselves to think that we know better than what God does sometimes. And our heart does deceive, it does trick us, and it is desperately wicked. Because it says, verse 10, I, the Lord, search the heart and test the mind. He knows us better than we know ourselves. Even to every man according to his ways and according to the fruit of his doings. You know the old saying, Father knows best. That's God. But in order to understand God's ways, brethren, we do need help. You could put in your notes Exodus 33:13. Moses says, I pray if I found grace in your sight, show me your way that I may know you and that I might find grace in your sight. Moses is asking God, I need help here, God. I can't do this by myself. I can't. We can't. I can't. God has to show us by opening up his mind or our minds. Right? And you can't just rest the Bible up against your head. You actually have to open it up and read it. As we read and heard in the sermonette about God's word being that sharp two-edged sword. You have to study it, make it be a part of who you are. That's how that trust is developed, because then we take less of us and we put more of what God wants for us to do. And all of a sudden, we start doing better in our lives. What are some of God's ways? I wrote some down. I started writing them. I had to stop because it was love, joy, peace, long-suffering, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, self-control, mercy, forgiveness, grace, compassion, holiness, perfection. The list goes on and on. But those are the qualities of God. And God says, as children of God, as God's children, he wants us to be just like him. And we become that light when we practice and live the life that God reflects in us. And yes, that is very much easier said than done. Read Romans 7. The Apostle Paul, right? The things I want to do, I don't. But thank God, he says, through Jesus Christ, I can, through all things, overcome with his help. You know, I read the story about Israel and how easy sometimes it is that we say, oh, you know, Israel had it easy, right? We go back and read Israel. Israel, when they're resurrected, is going to look at us and go, what a bunch of knuckleheads. You had God's Spirit and you had our examples here and you still sinned. We look at Israel and go, you mean you walked with God and you saw all those miracles and you still sinned? What a bunch of knuckleheads. It's not easy. If it was easy, everybody would be doing it. God says this is the better resurrection, right? There's a better prize for us if we just stick to the truth, if we follow him and we get rid of our own ways of doing things. Let's go to 1 Peter chapter 2. Again, how can we be that city on a hill? How can we walk in his ways? I'm going to read this from the New Living Translation, 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 11. First Peter 2:11. Dear friends, I warn you. New King James Version says, I beg you. He's begging us. As temporary residents and foreigners, aren't we supposed to be pilgrims in this world? God says, don't be a part of this world. Christ says, don't take them out of the world. Leave them there. But he gives us his Spirit to help us overcome, to change, right? He says, as temporary residents and foreigners, keep away from worldly desires. The King James Version says, abstain from lustful flesh that wage war against your very souls. Again, sometimes that's so much easier said than done. And for some of us, it's easier than others. And some of us, it's more difficult. But again, he's telling us, how do we be that city on a hill? How can we walk in his ways? He says, avoid those things that are going to get you in trouble. These phones. Young people, put a filter on it. Watch what you're doing. They're dangerous. Again, I've said it before and I'll say it again. Probably the greatest tool the devil ever invented was the cell phone. Be careful, verse 12, to live properly among your unbelieving neighbors. Then, even if they accuse you of doing wrong, they will see your honorable behavior and will give honor to God when he judges the world. Because your neighbors watch you. They watched you today when you left for church and you dressed up in a suit and tie or dress. Bunch of weirdos going to church on Saturday. What are they thinking? They'll know someday, but you're setting the example. You're being a city on a hill. Dropping down to verse 21, he gives us another way to do this. He says, for this you were called because Christ also suffered for us, leaving us an example that you should follow in his steps. You know, there's an old saying, you know, WWJD, what would Jesus do? What would you do if Jesus was sitting right next to you? How would you live your life? Would you go on that site that you weren't supposed to see if you knew that Jesus was looking right over your shoulder? Because he is. He's right there with us. And if you have his Spirit, he's living in you. He's a part of you. God says, I need you to change and become more like me and be that city on a hill. Point number two, how we can be a city on a hill. Keep his commandments. Keep his commandments. Most Christians claim they keep them. They claim they keep the commandments. James 2:10 says that if whoever will keep the whole law yet stumble in one point is guilty of all. So they might keep one or two or three or four or maybe even eight or nine. But God says we need to keep all 10. Let's go to 1 John chapter 5. 1 John chapter 5. Verse 2. By this we know that we love the children of God when we love God and keep his commandments. For this is the love of God, that we keep his commandments, and his commandments are not burdensome. The word burdensome in the Greek means grievous, heavy, or heavy in weight, or stern. They're not stern. In 1995, when our church split, right, everybody, most of the people that listened to that message, and they heard that it was okay to go out and keep Saturday or Sunday as the Sabbath, or keep Christmas, it's okay to eat pork and all that other good stuff, right? Everybody left because they said, and there's a weight that's lifted off us, that burden, we don't have to keep that anymore. God says that my commandments are not burdensome. They're not heavy. They're there to help us. They're there because it's the way we show love to God. It's the way we show love to others. It's a love thing. And it's commanded to us. So what does it look like to be a city on a hill to keep his commandments? I broke the Ten Commandments down, and I'm just going to share with you a little bit of each one of these. Number one, he says, don't have any other gods before me. Because it all starts with putting God first and making him the priority. And when we make God the priority, everything in our life goes better. My wife will tell you, when my relationship with her isn't very good, or when I'm having a bad day at work, or maybe I'm struggling with somebody here at church, you know what she always tells me? How's your relationship with God? You know, every single time, she's right. Because if my relationship isn't right, if he's not the priority, everything in my life is chaotic. It's stressful. And people who know me see that. And when I'm at peace, they see that too. And that's how we become a city on a hill, when we make God the priority in our lives. Number two, not having any graven images. These are idols. You know, instead of trying to create what God looks like in his image, it says in Genesis 1 that we were created in his image. This means that we need to be, again, shining our light and reflecting his way of life in us. I've said this before and I'll say it again. We keep this commandment by showing his light and being an image of him in our lives. Number three, not taking God's name in vain. This isn't just about cursing. We hear this a lot, especially when I go play golf. Somebody hits a bad shot and I hear the name Jesus Christ being yelled at. I'm like, he didn't hit that shot. You did. Right? Don't need to be bringing him up in this. But, you know, this commandment also involves saying that we are God's special people and not acting like it. That's taking God's name in vain. Again, people are watching what we do. And we need to be that city on the hill. The fourth one, I would like to go to Exodus chapter 31, please. Exodus 31 and verse 12. This is keeping God's Sabbath. Keeping God's Sabbath holy. Exodus 31, verse 12. The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the children of Israel, saying, surely my Sabbaths you will keep. For it is a sign between me and you throughout your generations, that you may know that I am the Lord who sanctifies you. That word sign means a signal, a beacon, or a monument. It's God's way of saying, I know who my people are because they keep my Sabbath, right? Just like the Statue of Liberty, we know is in New York. We know that the Eiffel Tower is in France or the Colosseum is in Rome. It's a way of showing where you are. God says, that's my Sabbath. That's how I know who my people are. And other people will know you by how you keep the Sabbath. Because ultimately, somebody somewhere in your life has said to you, where are you going today? How come you're not working on the Sabbath? And you're going to give them the answer. And that's how you become a city on a hill, by showing them that example of how you do things. Number five, honoring your parents. Learning how to honor your parents teaches us how to honor God and how we love others. It starts at a young age. And there's nothing worse than a disrespectful child. And again, our light shines when we set the right example by obeying our parents. Now, my parents always used to tell me when I used to leave the house, you know, remember, you're a Cimino. You reflect my name. Right? Other people will know you by us and how you do things. Well, guess what? We all have the name of God on us, don't we? We're His children. So when we go out into the world, we need to be reflecting His light and acting like Him so that we could be that city on a hill. Number six, don't murder. Some of us, this is easy. Nobody killed each other. Nobody killed somebody today because we're all still here. I guess staying off the posters at the post office is one way to let your light shine. But you know, it says in 1 John 3:15 that if you even hate your brother, you're a murderer. And how do we do with that? How do we do with that? Our light shines when we turn the other cheek, and we learn to love others, maybe the ones that we don't like, and we show them forgiveness. Again, we're going against the grain, because this world says an eye for an eye, right? You hurt me, I'm going to hurt you. God says, no, that's not how it works. Because when you love each other, God says, that's how you reflect my light in you. Number seven, not committing adultery. According to the PR Newswire, in the United States, 71% of men and women admit to cheating on their spouse. God ordained marriage, brethren, to be sacred for one husband and one wife. And when we have a happy, monogamous relationship, we shine our lights and show others that respect. I love that my parents just celebrated their 60th wedding anniversary. Two of the happiest people I've ever met in my life. Right? And others, and they see that, they see God. That's how God ordained to be marriage to be. Happy, healthy, monogamous, by letting their light shine. Number eight, don't steal. I know I'm sure some of you, most of you have had things stolen in your life. I had a bike stolen when I was 10 years old, never forgot it. But we're a city on a hill when we respect other people's possessions. We also keep this commandment by working hard and fulfilling what it says in Ecclesiastes, that whatever our hand finds to do, we do it with all of our might, because we're not cheating our employers of their time. Again, this means our teachers, our employers, our family, everyone, they see what you are. They know if you're a hardworking person and you're giving 100% of your effort and time, that means something. That means you're shining your light to other people. Number nine, don't lie. According to a study by the University of Wisconsin, people who tell white lies make up 88%. I'm sorry, 88% reported they gave up little white lies, and 11.4% characterize them as big lies. Now, I don't care if the lie is yellow, green, purple, red, orange, pink, black, or yellow. It is a lie is a lie is a lie, right? And when we bear false witness, we become untrustworthy, and we're not looked at in a positive light. Nobody likes somebody who's a liar, somebody who can't tell the truth. But if you could be trusted, then you're a light and an example for God's way. Number 10, don't covet. The word covet in the Greek means to set the heart upon. It's longing for what others have that's not yours. And it's really saying that the other person has something that you don't have and they don't deserve it because they're not worth it. That's not right. Because our light shines when we're happy for what others have and we're thankful for what God has given us. Right? Remember what I said before about knowing what's right and thinking what's best in our own eyes? Right? And our hearts are bigger and our minds are bigger than what God wants. We're coveting. And that's not a good way to shine your light. And my last point, which is we heard in the sermonette, number three, how we're going to be a city on a hill is to stay alert. Stay alert. I don't know, have you ever been driving somewhere and you get sleepy? Remember, you take a road trip? I had my wife and I went to a wedding a few years ago, and we just got our car, and it had that driver assist on it. And I don't know, somewhere around 2:30 in the morning, I must have fell asleep at the wheel, and the car was just driving by itself. But you need to stay awake, I guess, is the point of the matter. And I got the elbow in the side to let me know that I needed to just wake up. Or maybe if you were in school, right, and you stayed up all night trying to study and you fell asleep, what happens when you wake up in the morning? You get drool on the paper, and it's never a good sign. It sticks to your head. Let's go to Matthew 24. Got to stay awake. Staying alert means being ready, and it's not necessary. I'm sorry. Staying alert and being ready is not only necessary for us during our regular lives, but more importantly for our spiritual walk with God. Matthew 24, verse 36. He says, but of that hour, or of that day and hour, no one knows, not even the angels of heaven, nor the Son, but only the Father. As it was in the days of Noah, so it will be at the coming of the Son of Man. For in the days before the flood, the people were eating and drinking and marrying and giving in marriage, up until the day that Noah entered the ark, and they knew nothing about what would happen until the flood came and took them all away. It was a party. Nobody was paying attention to what was going on. Life was just going to go on and on just the same way. God says, and he continues on and says, this is how it will be at the coming of the Son of Man. Again, remember what I said earlier. If you want to know what God's going to do, look what he did. He's referencing here back to the time of Noah on how it's going to be when Christ returns. Nobody in this world's paying attention to what's going on. Nobody cares about what God is doing or what he wants. He says in verse 42, will be in the field, one will be taken, the other left. Two will be grinding at the mill, one will be taken, the other left. Therefore, keep watch, because you do not know on what day the Lord will come. But understand this, if the owner of the house had known what time the night the thief was coming, he would have kept watch and would have not let his house be broken into. So you must also be ready. That word ready means internal fitness or being prepared or alert. Internal fitness. Having God's Spirit working in you. Because the Son of Man will come in an hour where you don't expect him. If we know that Christ is going to come on August the 15th of 2026, how many people are going to get ready just up until that point in time? Brother, we're not guaranteed another breath of our lives today. And if Christ came back today or tomorrow, will you be ready? That scares me. That's what keeps me going every day. Because I know I'm not ready. I know I've got a lot of work to do. But he calls us to get ready, to stay spiritually sharp. Because others will see you being that city on a hill by your attitude and your actions. They should see somebody who's happy, who's well-informed, who's got a good head on their shoulders, who doesn't let things get blown out of proportion or get worried when times get tough. Remember, the duck on the pond always looks good, but it's kicking like crazy underneath, isn't it? That's how people should see us in this life. They shouldn't see us kicking. They should see us swimming along nice and easy. I don't have time to read the parable of the 10 virgins in Matthew 25. But as we heard earlier in our first message, they all slumbered and slept. Right? They didn't have enough oil in their lamps to keep them going. Brethren, don't let that happen to us. We need to let that light shine. We need to have that fire inside of us to continue to change and grow and overcome. John Winthrop tried to warn those who came into this country to be a city on the hill. He told those who, if you didn't obey God, he says, if you did obey God, you would be blessed. And if you didn't, you would be cursed. He told the same thing to Israel. He said, you're to be that model nation, to be a city on a hill. And as we draw closer to the return of Jesus Christ, let's remember that we too are to be that city on a hill. And we could do this by walking in his ways, keeping his commandments, and staying alert and being ready. Brethren, may God speed his kingdom, and may we all let our lights shine.